Today is Friday, September 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump continues to take aim at impeachment proceedings.
It's a disgrace to our country. It's another witch hunt. Here we go again. It's Adam Schiff and his crew making up stories.
Also ahead, reactions as Washington moves to limit the number of refugees it takes in annually, and we look at the global health preparedness as officials warn that inaction will have grim consequences. Those stories and more next. Still seething over the whistleblower complaint that triggered a House of Representatives impeachment inquiry, U.S. President Donald Trump returned to Washington Thursday, lashing out at congressional Democrats and the news media, and darkly hinting at retribution for government officials who assisted the whistleblower in accusing the president of misusing his powers of office.
My call was perfect. The president yesterday of Ukraine said there was no pressure put on him whatsoever, none whatsoever. And he said it loud and clear for the press. What these guys are doing, Democrats are doing to this country, is a disgrace, and it shouldn't be allowed. There should be a way of stopping it.
Republican Senator Lindsey Graham agrees with the president, saying there had been nothing done improper.
This phone call is a nothing burger in terms of a quid pro quo. The President of the United States did not remotely suggest to the Ukraine, if you don't do my political bidding against the Bidens, I'm going to cut your money off.
But Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal disagreed.
Donald Trump is going to choke on this supposed nothing burger. He will go down with this supposed nothing burger in his throat, because what it shows is repeated, concerted, premeditated criminal conduct.
While partisan remarks are to be expected in the halls of Congress, there are Republicans elsewhere who find the complaint troubling. Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker, a moderate Republican who leads a state with a Democratic-controlled legislator, spoke with Boston TV station WHDA.
Based on the stuff that I've read, it's a deeply disturbing situation and circumstance, and I think the proper role and responsibility for Congress at this point is to investigate it and get to the bottom of it.
Furthermore, House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi on Friday accused U.S. Attorney General William Barr of going rogue in the Justice Department's handling of the whistleblower report. Now, to unpack what we know about the complaint and to put things in the context is David M. Barrett, professor in the Political Science Department at Villanova University. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
So I want to begin here with the complaint itself. I mean, you have the president calling it a hoax. You have Republicans and Democrats alike saying there's something to look into. After reviewing the memo call that was released and the whistleblower complaint and the IG statement, what do you make out of everything that's taking place in Congress?
Well, I am struck by the extreme rhetoric going on. The president yesterday implying that the whistleblower and people who assisted or gave information to the whistleblower, implying that they should be executed. So that's really extreme rhetoric. Also in Congress, you know, talking as that senator did who you just played, the president choking on a nothing burger. So the rhetoric is extreme. But to move to the evidence that we have at hand, it's clear that the president urged the leader of the Ukraine to have his government, his people, look into Joe Biden. The president is urging the leader of another country to investigate a rival here at home of the president. And it seems to me that is, at a minimum, it's just
worth looking into.
Improper. Absolutely worth looking into. Absolutely. So for the president to say that this is simply made up, I think people should read the available documents. And if I may add, I hope that eventually we get to see, or at least the relevant committees get to see of Congress, the full transcript. That thing should still exist. It would have been illegal to destroy it, so I'm trying to assume it still exists, because what we have seen is not a full transcript. It is a rough and partial transcript.
Right. So. It's a memorandum of the telephone call, right. Not a verbatim transcript. And the document itself actually shows that, and you can actually read it for yourself here at voanews.com. I wanted to ask you really quickly, you know, Acting Director of National Intelligence McGuire testified yesterday, both before the House and the Senate, and he made a point saying that, you know, the IG did look into it, found the allegations credible and worth examining. Yes. Is there anything that we need to know about whether the process was followed correctly? Because the IG and the acting DNI said that that appeared to, you know, the whistleblower followed the established rules.
Well, I think it took a lot of courage on the part of the acting DNI to say that. He caught a lot of heat from some members of the House Intelligence Committee for being slow. That's maybe putting it mildly, at passing on information to the intelligence committees. But yesterday, the acting DNI stood up for the whistleblower and Inspector General, and that puts him, the acting DNI, in an incredibly difficult, awkward position with the president. Intelligence leaders are always sort of caught in difficult positions because presidents typically don't want to hear what they don't want to hear, and Trump is maybe especially that way. But the job of intelligence leaders is to present the truth as best they can understand it to a president and others, and I think that is what the DNI was doing, was giving his honest assessment of the whistleblower, and I think, you know, good for the acting DNI.
David Barrett is professor in the Political Science Department at Villanova University. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Angry protesters in Cite Soleil, a poor slum in Haiti's capital of Port-au-Prince, ransacked the headquarters of the Department Unit of Maintenance of Order Security Forces. A mobile video sent to VOA Creole Service showed protesters with chairs, gas drums, and various other items walking out of the building. Opposition group Long Live Haiti, in concert with the Petro Challengers, an assortment of anti-corruption young professionals and millennials, called for people to mobilize to demand the president's resignation. Britain's looming exit from the European Union carries real risks that medicines and healthcare supplies will be delayed. The UK's public spending watchdog said on Friday, and an influential lawmaker said a no-deal Brexit may have the gravest of consequences. While Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government has taken some steps to manage the risks, the National Audit Office said in a report there is still significant work to be done. Nigerian police freed more than 300 people, mostly children, being held in chains in a building in the northern city of Kaduna, a police spokesman said on Friday. Many of the children had metal chains around their ankles, police said. The spokesman said the building housed an Islamic school and 7 people have been arrested. The Trump administration has proposed accepting a maximum of 18,000 refugees in the coming year and what would be the lowest refugee ceiling in the country's history. If the government follows through, 2020 will be the third year of significant cuts to refugee resettlements under U.S. President Donald Trump. For now, however, the latest figure remains a proposal. The final decision in the form of the so-called presidential determination will be made in the coming weeks after required consultations with Congress, according to a senior administration official on a background briefing on Thursday. In response to Thursday's announcement, Refugees International President Eric Schwartz said, quote, "What President Trump says is difficult for the United States, taking in 18,000 over a year. Colombia does every 4 days. What a sad commentary on American leadership," end quote. Representative Elliot L. Engel, chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, called the cap an outrage and an attack on the refugee resettlement program. However, the U.S. State Department said, quote, "The current burdens on U.S. immigration system must be alleviated before it is again possible to resettle large number of refugees," end quote. Joining us now on the phone is Dr. Stephanie Nowin, associate professor and co-director of the Center for Gender in Global Context at Michigan State University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
So I wanted to get your initial reaction to this proposed cap of 18,000 refugees a year.
Well, it is shockingly low number, incredibly depressing, given that this will be, if we reach this ceiling, which often most years we don't, it will still be the lowest number we have resettled in the entirety of the refugee resettlement program's history. That goes back to the Refugee Act of 1980. I know some people are actually relieved that it wasn't zero, but it's going to be catastrophic for refugees who were hoping to be resettled in the United States, who desperately need the kind of protection that they can only get through resettlement. And it's going to be devastating to the resettlement infrastructure we have in this country.
Can you speak a little bit more about that? What do you mean by the resettlement infrastructure?
Well, like any government or NGO program, and the resettlement system is actually a combination of both of those, you need organizations that, coordinate the work. You need people who have the expertise and the experience to implement the program. So since the Trump administration took office, we've lost almost, or actually slightly more now, than half of all the local resettlement offices across the country. They've closed because resettlement has been so low that they haven't had any refugees to resettle. And this incredibly low number is just going to continue that. And further, this work of vetting refugees starts at the State Department, and the State Department has been losing the experts that have worked in the State Department for years, developing the expertise to be able to properly vet and identify refugees who really should be, not just in the refugees' interest, but it's in the U.S. government's best interest to resettle them here. So as the numbers continue to drop, there's less work for resettlement workers to do. There's less work for State Department officials to do. Those jobs just disappear. Those people go on to do other kinds of work, and it guts the infrastructure that we have to do resettlement so that in future years, if we have a new president that raises the ceiling, we won't have the infrastructure to even do that. So these changes that have happened in the past 3 years are actually going to have repercussions going out at least 10 years from now.
Dr. Stephanie Nawin is Associate Professor and Co-Director of Center for Gender in Global Context at Michigan State University. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers using a variety of space and ground-based telescopes say they have spotted a very rare system of three monster black holes that are on the path to a spectacular collision and merger. The triple black hole system was discovered at the center of three galaxies that had merged with each other. This trinary system is said to be located about a billion light years away and are each separated by distances that range between 10,000 to 30,000 light years. Astronomers say they found evidence that the giant black holes are actively feeding on surrounding material. The system was first spotted by the ground-based Sloan Digital Sky Survey in New Mexico. NASA space telescopes such as WISE, Chandra, Hubble, and NuSTAR were also used to gather data on the triple black hole system. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A Pakistani court has found the brother of a slain social media model, Kandil Balok, guilty of her 2016 murder and sentenced him to life in prison. Balok, age 26, was found strangled in her home near the city of Multan. She was killed shortly after posting pictures on Facebook of herself with a Muslim cleric who was later arrested for his alleged involvement in the murder. Balok's brother, Mohammed Wasim Azim, had confessed to her killing. Friday's decision by a judge in Multan acquitted four other suspects, including the cleric Mufti Abdul Kawi. Nearly 1,000 Pakistani women are murdered by close relatives each year in so-called honor killings for violating conservative norms on love and marriage.
J.
General Joseph Dunford, the nation's top general as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is leaving office next week. As VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reports, the top military advisor to the president will be remembered for his handling of the ISIS crisis, his tenure during the ongoing conflict in Afghanistan, and his efforts to strengthen the military amid growing tensions with Russia and China.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
General Joseph Dunford led the military under two very different presidents, garnering respect from both sides of the political aisle and from military experts. Michael O'Hanlon is with the Brookings Institute.
I think General Dunford has been one of the best chairmen we've ever had, and it's not always easy to measure by the state of the world.
The general is retiring amid increased tensions with Iran and rising violence in Afghanistan.
When I think about Afghanistan, I think about two things. Number one is we don't want Afghanistan to be a sanctuary from which the homeland can be threatened, the American people and our allies can be threatened. And the other is we want peace and stability in Afghanistan for the Afghan people.
Ensuring these objectives strained negotiations between the U.S. and the Taliban. Dunford has pushed throughout the process to make sure the military can still take out terrorists there, despite President Trump's desire to pull some troops out of the country. The spokesman for the chairman, Air Force Colonel Pat Ryder, pointed out in a recent briefing that in the Middle East, Dunford led the charge that crushed the Islamic State caliphate in Iraq and Syria.
If you go back 4 years and you look at the difference in terms of the presence of ISIS and what they had achieved then and where they are today, certainly there's been progress.
And experts like O'Hanlon credit Dunford's calm, steady leadership with keeping the U.S. out of a conflict with North Korea.
We went through 2017, the locked and loaded fire and fury, my button's bigger than yours, all that brinkmanship needed to be survived and be prevented from taking us into war. And I think Dunford had a role in that as well.
While the United States remains entangled in conflicts, most agree the American military is stronger under his leadership, modernizing and growing in an effort to stay ahead of great powers Russia and China. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Activists are warning of an epidemic of mental health problems and suicide among Australian farmers. Isolation, financial pressures, and the impact of drought are all part of the problem. Phil Mercer in Sydney reports that the rates of suicide for male farm workers are far higher than for the general population.
7 days a week, Joe Maghetto is up before dawn on his dairy farm near the town of Warragul, 100 kilometres southeast of Melbourne in southern Australia. He's the son of Italian migrants. He's tough and hard-working, but for years, he's battled the demons of mental illness.
I used to carry a bullet around in my pocket, and I remember talking to my brother one day on the road just here. I was bringing the cows home on the road, and I was talking to him, and I was angry at the time, and I kept this bullet in my pocket all the time, and I got the bullet out and I said to my brother, I showed it to him and I said, one day I'm going to blow my bloody head off, you know. I was really down in the dumps, and by that afternoon I was milking the cows, and before I knew it there was two policemen at the milking shed, and they pulled me out of the shed and they had a bit of a talk, and before I knew it the guns were seized.
Counselling, support from the community and small doses of medication have helped Joe to fight his mental illness. Campaigners believe much more needs to be done to help those struggling to cope on Australian farms. Suicide rates for male farm workers are reported to be twice those for the general population. Associate Professor Leah Bryant is from the University of South Australia. She believes that capitalism disadvantages those on the land because it takes power away from individual farmers and puts it into the hands of big corporations who control the prices producers receive.
I think it's imperative we turn away from that concept of mental ill health and think about our context of our policies, our state government policies, our federal government policies. We think about how corporate agriculture functions and challenge that. And most importantly, we challenge capitalism and the way it constructs the farmer and takes away, strips the autonomy of the farmer and produces distress.
Researchers also say that unprecedented weather events across Australia have had a clear and devastating impact on the mental health of many people, not just farmers. Droughts, bushfires and floods have caused the loss of homes, land and livelihoods. Australia is the world's driest inhabited continent. Last summer was the hottest ever recorded. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This week, world leaders at the United Nations General Assembly heard warnings about massive loss of life and diseases that could circle the globe in just 3 days. VOA's Carol Pearson reports that a special global preparedness monitoring group issued a report that says inaction on medical issues will have grim consequences. The report said eventually, heavily depends on political and social action, as well as good medical care.
AIDS is no longer the threat it once was. Treatment has changed that, and research on a vaccine is promising. There's talk now about ending malaria in the next 30 years. Malaria kills 500,000 people each year, most of them children. Scientists are also closing in on Ebola. A vaccine to prevent Ebola, plus two new drugs to treat those who have it, are saving lives in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Ebola used to kill up to 90% of its victims. But Dr. Anthony Fauci says, with treatment, chances of dying now depend on how much of the virus is in a person's bloodstream.
If you get a low viral load, the mortality goes down to around 10%.
Fauci heads research on infectious diseases at the U.S. National Institutes of Health. He's also a member of the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board. The board is an independent group called together by the World Health Organization and the World Bank to assess global preparedness for outbreaks of disease and other health emergencies. In its first report, the board warned that the world is woefully unprepared. So unprepared that the next pandemic caused by a deadly virus or bacterium or other agent could kill up to 80 million people and cause enormous economic suffering. The report was intended for political leaders worldwide.
If this had been the defense or military preparations in a country, it would not only have been the defense minister, but the whole government and the prime minister or president responsible. This has to be the same in global health security.
During a recent trip to East Africa, Dr. Fauci was pleased with the medical practices being used to contain the Ebola virus.
I was clearly impressed at the capabilities of the Congolese who were administering the care here, as well as the preparedness of the Rwandans and the Ugandans in case cases spill over the border.
In its report, the board cited political and social obstacles in reducing the threat of many diseases. TB, HIV/AIDS, Ebola, and others carry a stigma and discourage treatment. The report also cited lack of infrastructure, clean water and sanitation, and lack of funding.
We need to have a stronger preparedness across the board to avoid unnecessary loss of life and large economic losses.
The report warned that political situations like conflict and forced migration enable the spread of disease. It urged countries to establish emergency preparedness from the local level on up, to build trust, and to work with each other. They said action is urgently needed to avoid the next pandemic and huge loss of life. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And before we go, we'll take a quick look back in time. It was on this day in 1825 that the first locomotive to haul a passenger train was operated by George Stephenson in England. And in 1935, Judy Garland, of the Wizard of Oz fame at age 13, signed a 7-year contract with movie studio MGM. And with that, that's going to do it for us and take us out into the weekend. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Dan Brown, engineer Nick Ivanoff, and of course our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you so much for listening. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile app, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great weekend.